Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Mad Jin. With guest co-hosts...
Canis Albinus.
Matt Zed.
Oh, yeah. I hear him anyway. That webcam hack going on.
That's right.
No, of course, I wouldn't do that to you.
I don't know if I should be offended or thankful. Am I not worth doing that to?
I don't know. I think it's.
I value that you so highly that I would not jeopardize our relationship that way.
Yeah, but for me, it's okay.
Don't worry. There have been no major incidents that have shaped our relationship.
Yep.
Just a ton of minor ones.
Hello, and welcome to episode 252. I'm guest co-host Matt Zed here with Dan Q.
Tomato, tomato, potato, potato.
Mad Jin.
Don't forget to heat it all up in a wood stove.
Canis Albinus.
Canis is here, and so is Candace.
And the Mian Team.
Four times not the charm, the Mian Team is the charm. Episode feedback for 250. Had a comment from Legalized Freedom here talking about, well, he says, I, for one, I am an orbital whore. This is in reference to Beyond Earth, of course, since you do not get orbital units too easily in Civ 5. At least the civilian sats anyway. They're cheap and effective for spamming food and production for sure, but the real reason I deploy so many is to get the resource spawns. That's interesting. You can get pretty much all your cities as strong as your capital. Takes a little longer to get to the production set in the web, but by that time all food is pretty good and can focus on production. Once you are happy with the resources, culture sats are huge boosts. Yeah, and satellites are pretty nice in Beyond Earth, for sure.
I don't mind the culture sats because, well, you pop them up and you get culture on all your tiles for the period of the satellite.
Yeah.
I just take offense to the food and production one. Just because of the resource spawn is completely random, and you have one and or two over a 60 turn time. And frankly, once you get your first one, it's mathematically cheaper just to build another one and toss the previous one.
But you can't sometimes.
Yeah, you can. You just set it up to always have some extras. So to me, that just introduces really annoying micro and stupidity with respect to RNG. I mean, if they gave you one every 10 turns over the 60 turns, then it would be an effectively useful satellite. Of course, then they'd also have to fix the system so that you can actually put a resource down on a tile that already had an improvement by burning down that previous improvement, which is not a hard thing to do. And, well, frankly, the other reason not to get those is just the tech path to them.
Yeah,
is so freaking expensive. Like, that tech path is way more expensive than any other tech path into food or production. And it goes nowhere near a victory plan, which is fine. I'm fine with the not near a victory plan, but it's so expensive to get to them. And then it's RNG garbage. Whereas, you know, with the culture or the gold for both of those satellites, they're at least either close and cheaper to get or within range of a victory path, so isn't exactly hard to get. And the culture one's definitely a purity related one anyways, so it's just more useful. I would prefer it to be a little bit cheaper, and especially the food one, to be closer to the harmony side than anything.
Or just place it so you get it in a reasonable time frame to use. Because that's true. I pretty much don't get the opportunity. But yeah, you might as well spam some kind of civilian satellite since they're not expensive.
Yeah. I get annoyed by just those two, the food and production ones. I mean,
well,
the sure.
The tech web itself definitely needs some tweaks. The incentives there are a little scary, but that is what it is.
Yeah. He also goes on to talk about military sats he doesn't find useful.
No.
Depends on which ones, frankly. The orbital laser skirt is 3 range, so you can get out there, and as long as you're not trying to drop it directly on top of a city or close to a city, it has its uses, especially if it's far away from your cities. Then you at least have something that can zat things.
I mean, isn't a domination victory just a race to orbital lasers?
Not really.
Planet carvers, really. And even then, they'll get nuked.
Or you can just wreck everybody with boats if you're not fighting other people. Yeah.
Some of the other military ones are useful, like basal transporters. That's very useful. Want the military on the other side of the planet? There you go.
That one's my favorite.
Especially because you can throw up the phasal transporter, move all your units over, delete the phasal transporter, and replace it with TACNET or orbital laser. The newer orbital one that extends your orbital coverage, that can actually be very useful. Well, for two reasons. One, to be able to just move your orbital coverage over to where you actually need it versus next to your cities, but also for all your units that gain bonuses while being underneath your orbital coverage. Makes them nicer.
And this all came in response, again, from Legalized Freedom's comment. On episode 250, we were taking in suggestions from the Civ community for a possible second expansion for Civilization Beyond Earth, although that itself was a segment that was recorded earlier in the year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and he also suggests that making all sets mobile at, say, one hex a turn would make them more useful.
That would make them more useful. I'm not sure
although
it's necessary, but there's no question that you can just like kind of move them around a little and do some extra micromanagement. Yay. But
moving sats just sounds like someone trying to get around one unit per tile.
Well, no, like that has major implications, especially for the military satellites, but even for the civilian ones, you could do some like tile yield stuff that you couldn't do otherwise with that. They wouldn't be as big on the Civi satellites, but the military satellites, if you can move planet carvers even one hex per turn, that has some implications for sure.
Yeah. Blast everything, move. Blast everything, move.
Yeah. I mean, you still have to build more of them because they have a limited time up there, but you'd get more utility out of one, and they're already pretty good, so.
Well, yeah, because say you can move the phasal transporter one hex per turn. All of a sudden, instead of having one ring skirt around, and that's how many units you can drop that turn, you then move it, and you add another three. And if you've got a couple of these, then you're dropping a lot of units very quickly in an area. Not necessarily a horrible thing, because the other person should be controlling their own orbital coverage, which of course is a problem for the AI, not doing that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But then again, most orbital units are in hard to reach locations on the tech trees, and the AIs just go hit that victory based tech first and then go, oh, I need 15 affinity levels for this. Oh yeah, I should probably go back and get those. Episode 251 feedback. Apparently people were not smart and did not actually listen to the advice at the beginning of the episode to send all mail to Dan. They just decided to post wherever they could find a post location. So I'll go to the YouTube one first, because Polycast is on YouTube, if you didn't know. Nagash said, man, I hate it when people complain about games like Civ lacking story, which is pretty much all we just said. Oh, and an aside to that, Ashes of Singularity, a new RTS game, just got lambasted by PC Gamer for not having story. just kind of funny. Still got 4 out of 5, though. Anyways, moving on. There are very few story-focused games that I played repeatedly, especially for the story. They rarely ever result in much variance between playthroughs, even in games meant to be story-focused like Telltale Games, and in many cases ended up impeding on gameplay experience by railroading in that, too, which is pretty much true. Story-based games are railroads. Really big railroads. Follow the story, or you get nothing. Games like Civ and Dwarf Fortress, games without a shred of story behind, beyond plonking you into a randomly generated world and asking if you can stand the test of time. Those are the games I've played endlessly and had stories play out that were richer and what I was more invested in than 99% of the games because they were mine and they evolved organically thanks to how little the game gave you. It was left blissfully blank so that the mind was free to work with the abstractions to develop a narrative. It's a boon, not a con. I doubt there are many writers in the industry that could write a story fit for the scale of Civ takes place on, let alone the myriad variations that players' minds will come up with across the many games they'll play. Which is basically saying Nagash agrees with everything we said last time.
Yeah, on the last episode, taking exception to a call to revive the quote-unquote stagnant 4X strategy genre, which a primary focus of that was, as you're probably getting to and realize, the lack of story that we find in 4X, or at least, as we said on the last episode, the parts of the 4X genre that the author accounted for in their article.
Yeah, and these are all points that basically just reinforce what we said. Let the player build the narrative. Without a railroaded story, you can actually replay the game and get interest and enjoyment out of it. because you're not railroaded onto the same story each and every single time.
But there was definitely interest in this topic because before we even recorded episode 251, we had a piece of feedback that tied into that very topic from Legalized Freedom.
Yeah, it's like he's showing up all over the place now. So over on the Dan's whole, this is what we're going to talk about thread, not even in the episode thread, buying into early access of the new Moo. He's incredibly impressed with how they handle it. Basically, he starts talking about how they actually solicit feedback and bug reporting, and they act on it with a very short turnaround, yada, yada, yada. And basically keeping good communication with the community as they build and modify and yada, yada, yada. Not really sure how that actually relates to the how to fix the 4X genre part, because what he's talking about is more development practices, which is what he's kind of touching on here. But the interaction with Minity as it's being built and getting the bug stuff, I mean, yeah, okay, that's good, but it doesn't have anything to do with the 4X side of it.
And yes, Moo being Master of Orion, not a new cowherd.
It's only Moo. Stop it. It's nice that they're in early access and they're taking feedback. The only problem I ever have with that is that if you do that, you have to select which feedback is useful and which is not. If you get a bunch of people who go, ooh, I've heard about this Moo thing before randomly, that must be a great game. Oh, I have to strategize and plan. I have to do this stuff. Well, that's not fun. Let's give feedback so that it's more RPG-ish, or where's the story?
You got to be able to find the gems for all the not-so-gems, shall we say, and then decide, even if this is a worthwhile piece of feedback, is this practical for what it is that we're trying to do and what it is that we want to do? That sounds like a really great idea, but that's not the game we're creating. We might bank that, and perhaps if we do a related game in the future, maybe we can keep that in mind. But it's also one of those things, when you get to those gems, it's like, wow, we'd like to include all of these things. So it's going to come out in 2020. Yeah. And at some point, you definitely have to be selective.
The post-episode version of feedback, Sheglio brought up discussion about when we were discussing anti-aircraft units versus fighters. It was mentioned that AA units can operate far afield, while fighters were limited by the range from the cities they're based in. He was waiting for someone to mention carriers, but no one did. So I had responded to the thread. It's like, we did have some minor discussion, but when we were talking about AA units, we were obviously talking about areas where it was on land and carriers can't go. Because if you're just going to spam carriers full of fighters and you're on a water map, then yeah, you don't need AA, because they're actually worse at that point. Just because, well, AA doesn't do so well in the water. In the middle of a Pangaea map, carriers definitely have no place. So that's where you have to think about AA versus cities and stuff like that for fighter range.
Yeah, I guess we could have mentioned that when you do have water, you can have very, very many planes, potentially. Yep. But that didn't occur to me to explicitly spell out. If you want to have AA and still bomb and no longer care about city constraints whatsoever, just get a couple of those promotions that let you carry more planes on your carriers, and then you can have, like, 20 to 30 planes, like, spot bombing one area and doing sweeps and stuff. Once you have the range, why not with triplanes? But later, fighters on.
That was our feedback.
Odd Gaming Investigation of Settlerless starts for Civilization V. This thread has been brought to us by Bismarck the Barb. I recently played a number of games where I tried to win Civ 5 after deleting the initial settler as a variation to standard play. It is easy to win with some leaders, but pretty hard with most. I have listed my findings regarding this in the list below, ranked after simplicity to succeed. Settings are Pangaea standard, everything with no reroll until win is deemed impossible and wins are played through to the end. And some points come up in conversation about, are you sure you're able to do this if you don't have a city? Are you sure you're able to access this if you don't have a city? About not having a city. The first city you capture becomes your capital and a palace appears. If it is a previous capital, then your city starts building a palace and you claim it as your capital too. And even though the cities become your capital when you capture them, you can still raise them. It just says you lost your capital when it goes. However, it does not prevent you from winning. And yes, without a city, you pay no maintenance. So, as person accounts that I built a 50-unit barb army one game without paying a cent. Must be, of course, referring to playing as Germany. Where, of course, you attack a unit and, hey, we've joined your tribe as a brute. It's like a plague of barbs, LOL, and I wiped out the entire world twice using the strategy and never owning any cities till I conquered all capitals at once at the end. City-state units spawn in the city-state territory if you don't have any. Part of it came up with you want to ally, for example, with a militaristic city-state to get yourself a melee unit if, say, you have your scout, and then it finds itself upgraded to an archer. Or, as an aside, not sure you need to worry about that, if, of course, you are playing the Huns, ha-ha, and you get an upgrade ruin, say, with a warrior that you get from a city-state, and now it becomes a battering ram, it is sweet. And, of course, no science progress is recorded until one settles their own city. But in this particular case, I'm not really certain you're that concerned about science so much as it is the rush. Is this kind of like trying to do a Zerg rush in Civ? Specifically mentions playing as Attila and Bismarck and Maria Theresa and Pocatello and Darius. Talk, someone said, hey, you know, you can go and adopt this thing called honor, get more culture from killing barbs. And someone's like, but how can you access the culture if you don't have a city? And it's true that the bar, in terms of how much culture you're generating and how much culture you have, plus your gold and your science, that bar is not going to appear. But you are still, for example, accumulating gold if you go into a ruin and find gold, or you go and you clear a barbarian hut. Or if you are killing barbarians and you're accumulating culture, as you raise the culture, screens become available. So even though you won't be prompted, you can start earning culture from barbarians. And if you play without one city challenge turned on, you can select a social policy if you have enough culture when you capture a city.
So you just have to lock on to enough city states or a ruin or something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is definitely odd gaming. I think that's a fair title. And I think this is also, well, seeing as how he mentioned the settings, I think this definitely works better on a more or less all land map, as opposed to, you know, unless you're playing as Polynesia, perhaps, you know, early on, let's delete our initial settler and go start squishing things across the world. Yeah, some map settings are better for this, and some civilizations are better for this. I think it's also mentioned in the thread in terms of difficulty level. It's generally noted that the highest someone was able to go where they were able to win the game through domination by deleting their initial settler was Prince. And some people also reported some success on Warlord, which also makes sense. Although, quite frankly, on a lot of difficulty levels, if maybe not all, if you just have like a dual size land-based map and you luck into finding the civ that you need to take out very quickly, and you find yourself some city-state allies, especially militaristic ones, that can start gifting you some units as well. I don't know, this is kind of one of those things to me that helps extend the gameplay.
Wait a minute, just saying, Bismarck said he went on deity with Attila and on immortal with Bismarck, so there are some higher difficulty wins depending on the civ chosen.
Okay, Attila, true. Go get Ruin, get upgraded to Battering Ram, run over the
I mean, you can map guess how it was done, other yes. Person.
Yeah. That, I mean, no, that is, I mean, but dual maps, you have to throw those away. Because dual maps, doesn't matter, any civ, any enemy AI civ, doesn't matter, it's one-on-one, you can wreck it.
If I'm reading the thread correctly, though, he's saying he went on deity on a standard settings Pangea, not dual.
Yeah, but I think...
And it's certainly possible with Attila, because you can get your first city so quickly, if you got an upgrade run.
Yeah, and actually, if you pick on a bunch of city-states, run from one city-state to another in a batch that with that battering ram, then yay.
Yeah.
And of course, yeah, once you get first city, you get more cities. So yeah, I can totally see Attila being plausible in that respect, because what you're really doing is just giving up your starting city, but hoping for the battering ram and then running people over. Bismarck, yeah, I mean, there's another thread entirely somewhere else about Bismarck and not using the settler.
That was by Dano Fobo, started a couple of years ago.
Yep.
Yeah.
Basically, it's just go get lots of barbs.
Yeah.
So it's entirely plausible as a different way of doing it.
And you get a lot more time on Immortal, so it's...
Yeah, than DD, yeah.
Then, yeah, after that, the difficulty highest plummets.
Oh, well, yeah, because it's also the civs getting mentioned also plummet. Inability to do that sort of thing. I'm surprised Assyria is not in there, but whatever. I guess you can't upgrade to a siege engine.
Yeah, that's probably why.
Yeah.
If you could do that. If you could do that, that'd just be silly. But yeah, the rest of them, like Pocatello, Darius, Maria Theresa, I mean, I see Maria Theresa being in there only if you can get enough cash together to have both ally a city-state and then promptly buy it out.
Yeah.
That's about the only way, because then you get everything from them. So
I mean, you find El Dorado early.
El Dorado!
Or you just kill enough barb camps, yes, I guess. Oh, yeah, you kill a barb camp near the city state. That way you get the alliance, and then you just use the money you've accrued to buy it. It's like playing with a 50-turn start delay, but if you're talking about playing on King, that's still winnable easily.
Yeah, you can completely ignore everything on King.
Yeah.
He says, noting that there's probably people out there who would disagree with that.
Hi.
No, I'm an
King is the highest I can go.
Another thread, this one by Danafinus, about lists of civs made OP by settings. This is a just-for-fun list of scenarios that are essentially OP given different civilizations' abilities and the map settings. Please help me construct a full list. Run these combinations if you want an easy game but snowballs. And then just getting into some examples listed here, Celts on Boreal for the faith bonus, Iroquois for similar-ish reasons in forests. You want Ink on Highlands.
I've done that.
Oh.
The third one, I've done that.
That's fun. There's Carthage on Archipelago, Indonesia on Archipelago, Polynesia on Archipelago, England.
Oh, I disagree with that one.
I disagree with a few, which I'd get into. There's, of course, Morocco on Desert, Brazil in Jungle, basically everyone where you would expect them.
But I didn't suggest Iroquois on Boreal because it was great, but rather just said that they were just somewhat a little bit more out of the complete and utter trash tier.
No, Iroquois is not trash tier as long as you have forests. If you have no forests, then, well, it's like Rome without iron. It's just
they're still only like one above trash tier, even if you do have forests.
But relative to their normal situation, that's OP. But yeah, they're not really the same as most of the civs here. I just want to point that out.
Well, it's more that their UB and UA and UU all go crazy when you have forests and mass spam of forests.
Well, the annoying thing about the UA is that you actually need to have the forest tiles for them to start working as roads for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, we need to have the wheel as well.
Yeah. Well,
and it needs to be in your borders, if I'm not mistaken, which sucks.
Yep. And then if you add a road to it and you walk, what, it's forest to road or road to forest that doesn't count as the reduced movement?
It's road to forest.
Yeah.
I've had that issue before. It's very annoying. I mean, for me, for Polynesian Archipelago, the talk about immediately can't explore and get all the runes. Well, whatever. Polynesian, any water-based one can do that. Doesn't have to be Archipelago. Guaranteed to meet everybody first. Well, not really, but okay. And easy Moi placement for cultured output. And that's really the part that I have a disagreement on for the Archipelago one. If it was large islands, then that's actually better for Moi placement, because Moi placement works when you have more land or coastal land to make them better. So if you have Archipelago, you have super tiny islands, and okay, you put down two or three Moi. Whoop-de-doo. They aren't getting boosted. Whereas if you actually have a coastline of like five or six, that produces a lot more, and you get better plus bonuses out of it.
I'm surprised no one mentioned Polynesia on, what is it, Terra? The one where you have a continent possibly without anyone else starting on it?
Well, that's just for fun.
Yeah,
that's
this is a
in the water
for
and just
fun,
say,
yes.
Screw you people, I'm out. I'll be over there.
Wait, that's for fun as compared to all these others, which is not for fun?
That's just the giggly one.
Yeah.
Polynesia and Terra is just bye. Help you over there with everything.
Point out one of them. Morocco on Desert. I mean, even if you are Morocco, are you actually building a cash box?
Well, if you have no other choice, but if you build the Petra,
mm-hmm.
And then you can build the Kasbah on the desert.
It's still only a 2-2 tile if you're working flat desert. I mean,
yeah,
part of the desert you like are the hills and the floodplains.
Yeah, but that's better than 0-0. And at least pays for itself.
Are you really going out of your way to do all that just to work those, though? I mean, there's usually enough land on that script that you can at least get a couple good cities and then start taking cities. I think that's roughly as quote-unquote OP as the Iroquois are. Not very.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it requires a few extra things. Your desert worth it. But
it's not like the one above it, like England just destroying crap on water maps.
Well, yeah, but that's just, can you replace Archipelago with water?
Yeah.
There you go. Everything's coastal. Have fun. Bye-bye. Brazil on heavy jungle map. Well, yeah. Except that you have to get started, so that takes a while.
Yeah, but your jungle bias is less of a screw job because everybody else gets it too.
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, it does acknowledge that it takes a while to take effect, but then I'm also thinking, and it's not clearly defined here, I mean, like in terms of snowballs, I think part of it's also dependent on what victory condition you think you're going for.
Well,
or you want.
I don't think it really matters because Brazil can just spam Brazil wood camps and just use all that. But yeah, I guess it sort of depends. I'd probably prefer TP spam anyways, the jungles.
Yeah, for the science, yes.
No. Dutch on the hot and wet. This is sounding... Yeah.
It's not just your mind that went there. Yep. Nope.
Yes, it is.
Okay, it's Candace's mind that did not go there. We'll talk about there's the exception. Okay.
Yes, if you have tons of marsh and floodplains, the Dutch boulders go silly. And it makes the map look pretty. So there's that too.
Oh, there's nothing prettier than a boulder.
Or like an entire field of boulders.
I should be on a t-shirt. There's nothing prettier than a boulder. I just walk around.
What do you mean? There's something definitely more pretty. It's the glowy radiation after a nuke strike.
That's true. That is a fact.
But in fact, you can have both of those things at the same time.
It is true.
But then the tulips look weird.
The nuke strike is definitely the more important of the two, however.
Is that a tulip?
I am not on the nuke-friendly bandwagon here. But anyway, that's the Aztecs with any high lake density preset with raging barbs.
Aztecs with lakes. Come on, don't you have dreams at night about Aztecs and just this giant lake being next to you? Is that just me?
Well, I mean, the floating garden's unique ability is very nice. And then, of course, the raging barbs is like, okay, yes, well.
Glad to know I'm not the only person who has dreams about Civ.
Oh, no, definitely not. I mean, Aztecs with any lake density preset, with or without raging barbs, or just even Aztecs with raging barbs, yes, can be, if capitalized on it properly. And I'm also assuming we're meaning that, you know, these civs are being controlled by humans because,
well, yeah.
The
not the surprise in the AI.
One assumes.
I know it could probably be the one said, but let's say it anyway.
Yeah, I know later in the thread it started getting questioned about whether Marathon or not Marathon and stuff like that, or huge map versus not huge map. And people were saying, oh, Aztecs actually is worse on Marathon because you get less stuff or other. But any of the civs that have early game unique units, especially all the ones that have warrior-based unique units, they definitely have a better OP-ness to them if it's on Marathon, because they can actually use those units and or spam them and upgrade them, at least for the ones that actually have promotions that carry over.
Yes. A Songhai on Pangaea Marathon Raging Barbs. Quoting here, the triple gold from Taking Encampments is great. We talked about Marathon. You can have so much gold you can buy your way through most early game builds. I get what they're getting at. I'm not so certain I'm going to go so far as to say OP here, though.
Well, I mean, we've already allowed Iroquois, so what's our definition of OP anymore?
Kind of that thing, though. And again, Marathon...
Yeah, from what they're saying, encampment spawn rate does not increase from Raging Barbs. Like, if you take down an encampment, it's going to respawn the same amount of time.
Yeah.
Now, Germans on Marathon Pangaea Raging Barbs, it's a double-edged sword. I think you've got a better chance there than with the Songhai. But even that's kind of...
No, it's the same thing as the Songhai, because you're looking to spawn camps, not units.
Now, if you were running the Piety with the missionary thing, heathen conversion or something, then go for the Raging Barbs on Marathon.
Oh, yeah, but if you're doing that, it's not a civ-specific thing. It's a, can I go get...
But that's where it's applicable, not having to take out a camp. If you didn't have to take out the camp, it would be different.
Well, and I'm saying German's better than the Songhai. Because of what the person says here, you can recruit a massive army to wipe out the world in the ancient era.
That's true. That's true. You definitely get more time to move around, heal, and kill stuff with the units you pick up. So in that sense, yes.
Yeah, I would definitely put German's UA over top of the Songhai one on that one.
And then, of course, I just laugh at Greece with max city-state numbers. Siam with max city-state numbers. Yes, well.
Can they both be OB?
Put them on the same map and then play as somebody else and watch the fun.
Yay! I don't think either of those really counts as an OP setting, per se. I mean, I guess it depends on the difficulty level you're playing on and whether or not the AI is even bothering with city-states. Even if you don't have a CS-related bonus, gets huge stuff from it if you go after all of them.
I think for just the decreased decay of influence, in that case, Greece would be better than Siam. I know you get more out of the city-states with Siam, but like you were saying, Matt, it also depends on other people going after those city-states in terms of actually trying to either ally them or, oh, do you have this city-state as an ally? Not anymore, because I just took it over. Oh.
Or Austria. That's not even a city-state anymore.
Ha-ha.
Or Venice.
Spain on huge map with reduced civ numbers. Well, Spain on blank map with reduced civ numbers.
Spain on Terra.
Yeah, that part doesn't really matter. I'm not sure Spain's... I mean, Spain OP is just how many natural wonders can Spain get first.
Yeah.
If we can get a bunch first, it doesn't matter the map.
Yeah.
Or the setting.
Just point into your luck skill and your OP.
Yep. Oh, luck skill.
Then we got Sweden on huge map with maxed Civ and CS numbers.
Ah, oh, that's a lot of moving parts.
I don't actually like Sweden on huge map just because you're great persons. Eventually, you're not going to have enough to just instantly bribe all the city-states. I like a more standard map for Sweden, just an easy Diplo victory.
Well, I think it's more that the fact that if it's going to be a huge map, there's more Civs for you to be friends with. I mean, that gives you your great person generation, so you get more percent. And if you can be friends with everybody, then you can really crank that up. But whatever.
Dana in the thread said that the requirements for an entry here must be overtly overpowered, not just moderately buffed, and be a clear synergy. Oh, synergy. Clear synergy between a Civ and a particular map style.
It's okay, Dan. We'll just shift your paradigm.
Someone say synergy?
Rage!
Yes, I said that to annoy Dan.
Yeah. But yeah, okay, so what else? What's not on this list that would possibly be considered OP if you basically just played with all the actual settings in the game?
Attila Pangea Marathon?
Yeah. But you could say that of a lot of Civs, though.
Assyria Pangea Marathon.
Attila in particular is like, the horse archers are so troll good, especially against the AI.
So Assyria with max city-states. Because all you need to do is build like 4 or 5 siege towers and just go from city state to city state. And all of a sudden, you're in the Renaissance!
That's, yeah, I guess. Yeah.
You still get the tech per.
The happiness might be a bit of a problem, though.
Well, you just hope that your city states actually have good lookers.
Yeah.
And now I'm thinking about the Mongols as well, in relation to the city states.
Yeah, they don't get Mongols the tech bonus from it.
Mongols just attack them better.
Yeah.
But they don't get actually anything out of doing that. Other than attacking them better.
Yeah, for domination.
Although certainly on Pangea you can win with their unique unit, but that's the Attila being able to do it right away, I think, is what makes them so strong.
Yeah. And besides, Mongols with Keshiks and enough horses, that's just strong anyways.
Yeah.
Or just making them even stronger to be overpowered. Ha, ha, ha.
Wah, wah, wah. Obviously, none of the science civs really matter on this one. They're already really strong.
Yep.
I guess one could make a case for Ottoman on any real watery map like Archipelago, just because of your navy size, and if you get it mostly water map, you're going to have a lot of fun.
But your unique units are both land units that are useless on a water map.
Yeah, that's the fun of the Ottomans. These things don't go together very well.
Synergy.
Anti-synergy.
In the time machine, doo-loo, doo-loo, doo-loo. Very old polycast sound effect.
I remember
sound
that
like
one.
You died as much.
Back in February of 1996, Civilization II was released. That was 20 years ago, which is older than some people possibly listening to this show. Sid Meier's Civilization II, developed and published by the now defunct Microprose. Microprose, rip. In addition to being released for the PC, Civ 2 was also released later on the Sony PlayStation, but we try not to talk about that in polite company. Civilization 2 was designed by Brian Reynolds. It was re-released in 1997 as Civilization 2 Multiplayer Gold Edition, which, guess what, focused on multiplayer. I know, right? Weird. Which bundled both prior expansion packs, Conflict and Civilization, which was essentially, here's a collection of scenarios, and Fantastic Worlds, while adding options for networked and hot seat play, and featured tweaked AI. A remake called Civilization II Test of Time was released in 1999, following Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri. It had a new palette and user interface, and a new feature such as animated units, a playable Alpha Centauri to settle, and new campaign modes. Yes, I'm reading directly off of an entry on Wikipedia. And I would also say Test of Time introduced being able to play on more than one map in a game. I remember playing Civilization 2. I had started only playing the original Civ in 1994, because that's when I first heard of it. A few years after it was released, it was before access to this little thing called the internet. And actually, this marks just over 20 years since I first got internet access. Wow. 28.8K connection on Windows 3.1. That was some kind of sweet, let me tell you. And I decided in my infinite wisdom, being 15 years old at the time, you know what a great idea is? I've never been to this city that's almost 500 kilometers away from my home. So that's a little under 300 miles. I'm going to buy a copy of Civilization 2 in this store that I've never heard of before and hope that it works on my computer when I get it home. Which it did, fortunately. I remember paying Civilization 2. That was like $80 or $85. I realize it was quote-unquote only Canadian dollars, I hear some people saying, ha-ha, back in the mid-90s. It was very expensive. Not the most I've spent on a computer game, but that's another story for another time. What I remember most otherwise, of course, from Civilization 2, and I think those who have played it will agree, would be the High Council.
We cannot sacrifice learning for luxuries.
Takes coin, not clowns, to keep an empire afloat.
My humble suggestion to your glorious person would be to build more caravans and trade with our unworthy neighbors.
No, your majesty. Wise men say that only fools run an empire without luxuries, king.
I disagree,
your excellency.
Speaking of story, earlier, it really added to the gameplay, what I call the meta gameplay, because I would be thinking about doing certain things in the game or not doing certain things in the game just to try to get the advisors to say something different, which may or may not have been conducive to actually winning the game. Although, as we previously discussed, Civilization 1 through Civilization 3 was just about more cities equals a greater win equals faster win equals better win equals more enjoyable win. Asterisks at some point, just building more and more cities actually did get tiresome. So as much as there is the longevity for the Civilization series, including Civilization 2, which was the first Civ title that really introduced and considered modding in any respect, which of course ended up being very significant for subsequent Civ titles as well, it's fair to say that as much as the original Civilization got me into playing Civ, it's Civilization 2 that kept me playing Civilization even after Civilization 3 was released, because then I went back and played Civilization 2 until Civilization 4 came about. Yay, Civ.
Oh, I still remember Civ 2. There's nothing like listening to the military advisor tell you about how your palace is going to be put to the torch.
Obviously, the relationship that failed between the military advisor and the culture advisor before the game ever started. They clearly had a thing going on, the way they talked to each other, the looks they gave.
And then they just spent thousands of years not fixing it. It's a shame.
Well, the culture advisor flirted with you to try to make the military advisor jealous. And now some people are listening and thinking, what? This is what you got from Civ 2? Well,
we need barracks, noble leader. Or would you have our soldiers sleeping on your palace steps? Give me more soldiers that they may sheathe their swords in the beating hearts of our enemies!
Dog.
And if I recall correctly, I don't even believe that when the High Council, like when that video was recorded, I don't believe the initial intention was to actually use that for Civilization 2, but for another game, and it ended up being repurposed in a more memorable way. There might have been subsequent lines or something that were recorded afterwards, but that wasn't the initial intention either, and it's just this wonderful thing that carries over.
Those little things that get lost in history that nobody remembers except the people who were there.
Indeed.
Someday things are going to be like that for Civ 5. I wonder what we'll remember from that 20 years from now.
Nothing.
Art Deco.
Actually, I probably will remember Art Deco because I love Art Deco.
Yeah, we'll look back on Civ 5 and think, oh, the glorious days when we got hexes.
Yeah. The glorious days when Sid finally gave up on wondering if people were going to be too geeky for using hexes and said, screw it, we're geeks, get over it.
Apparently it was a good change because all the other games that I see that are like this seem to be either hex-based or don't use tiles.
Oh, and I mean, it's clear. We'll be looking back and saying, wow, man, Civilization 5 introduced hexes? I mean, only bested by the introduction of triangles in Civilization 10.
Mm, true. Oh, I'm looking forward to triangles.
Civilization 2 Test of Time. It was the last Civilization title on the PC released in the 20th century.
Ooh.
Bet you hadn't thought about that before, huh?
Nope, still didn't care. I actually was playing completely other 4X games on completely other consoles at the time. So,
and I mentioned about not talking about the Sony PlayStation port of Civ 2 in polite company, because I played it a couple of times at a friend's house. I did not own a Sony PlayStation myself, but I really love Civ. And I couldn't understand why he loved Civ on the PlayStation. He never played it on the PC, because there really wasn't any consideration given to, I wonder if perhaps when you're using a controller, it's different than a keyboard and mouse. It was just controller equals keyboard. And,
yeah, no.
And I guess I also have an affinity for Civilization 2 because brag. It was the first Civilization title that I ever beta tested. Specifically, what became Multiplayer Gold Edition, but was initially called Ultimate Civilization 2, of which I still have a CD. I almost want to say you see kids, there are these things called CDs. We'll soon be having that conversation. with Ultimate Civ 2 on it. Which was great. And my first multiplayer game of Civ was Hot Seat with a friend. And I remember thinking,
good you qualified that.
This is just taking too long. Multiplayer Civ, I don't see myself doing that. And so, you know, amongst those words that you end up eating. although admittedly, it wasn't in Civilization 2, so I can be forgiven a little bit. Plus, I was also young. So,
well, you know, Hot Seat's Hot Seat.
I like Civ 2 because it was the first Civ game I ever played, and quite a young boy at the time. And I remember playing the game, and I'm like, wait, there are nuclear weapons I can use? And how do I get that? And then, for some reason, I kept playing Civ.
And then, what the hell, Gandhi?
No. Oh. I thought we were friends, man. I thought we were friends.
Well, I'm certain you were his friend. He remembers you fondly. More fondly than all of his foes.
He remembers me warmly, is how he remembers me.
The incredibly intelligent, apparently, Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, has decided in their infinite wisdom that Sid Meier's Civilization is a game worth putting in their most influential titles list, even though they didn't do it last year.
And it's just a nominee right now. It wasn't even a nominee last year, and it's just a nominee now. There's still no guarantee they're actually going to put it in their Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Tetris is more influential. I guess it's more influential because it's the only computerized thing that ever came out of the Soviet Union. But World of Warcraft, I mean, other than a lifelong addiction that causes serious social and medical problems, I don't see why that should be on the list of things that already did. And there are plenty of things in this list of influential titles that they're putting on the possible list this year that should have been there already, like Oregon Trail. I don't know why Minecraft is on the list. It's not old enough.
It's interesting you bring that up, because its selection criteria includes a game status as an icon, its longevity, geographical reach, influence on other games, entertainment, or pop culture. According to the Strong Museum, the final criterion can be considered even if the others have not been met.
Oh, so basically, it's just a popularity contest. Oh, sorry,
yeah. That's what it was from the start. What's Nürburgring, by the way?
Nerd herding?
What? No, Nürburgring. I'm noticing that's on the list, but that's one of the only ones I don't recognize offhand.
I'm guessing it's a European game based on the Ring of the Nibelungenlied, which would be a very old.
Find out.
I mean, it certainly looks old because it's got the arcade machines on its cover, but I can't see enough detail there to even make out the genre, exactly what kind of gameplay that entails.
Okay, I'm going to have to adjust
this. Oh, it's a racing game.
Okay.
It's a 150,000 capacity motorsports complex in the town of Nuremberg, Rhineland-Palatinate, Germany.
Okay.
Was it cared for? Why?
I'm just wondering why that was picked over any other racing game.
Was it the first racing game?
Oh, it could be.
Don't know, but...
Because it's mostly talking about 2012, so the answer to that is no.
I mean, I'm having even trouble just finding this game on Google. How popular of a game was this?
Not really.
And I disagree with the inclusion of some of the other titles, but I've at least played them in familiar.
Why is Elite even on the list?
Well, yeah.
Why is GTA 3 even on the list?
A lot of people play the GTA thing. And although, it had, like, such a media storm over it that, like, I can understand why you would consider putting it here for influential, like...
Tomb Raider? Really? Which one?
not so much about Tomb Raider. I don't think Tomb Raider belongs.
Well, seeing as how they've mentioned specifically like Grand Theft Auto 3 and Street Fighter 2 as nominees this year, I guess when they say they mean the first one, just like when I see Sid Meier's Civilization, I'm assuming they're talking about the first one.
Yeah, I guess if you actually look up to the image, it actually shows the old one.
Also, they still make the Tomb Raider series, so it certainly wins on longevity compared to some of the titles here, anyway. Some of them are much older still, like Sonic or Final Fantasy or Zelda.
I guess with
or
Tomb Raider, they also have the movies and other stuff that run off of it.
Yeah, I guess. It makes sense to see it.
Here's a big question. Where's SimCity? Because that was a major icon back in the days.
Mm-hmm. Did that that like win in a previous year or something?
Sims. They're rolling that into The Sims, then I'm taking their gamer card, if I haven't already.
Yeah, like, I would too. Oh. There's no way. Those are not the same thing. They're not even close to the same thing. That's like rolling in Civilization with Call of Duty or something.
Yeah. Where's Populous? Seriously.
Oh, yeah. I guess it didn't last long enough, right?
No, it did last long enough, and it spawned off Civ and some other games.
Its original core gameplay shifted pretty hard after 2 or so.
Yeah. I mean, but the original stuff was better.
Despite its later issues, and I especially say this in context of some of the other titles on here, what about like King's Quest?
What about Mom?
What about Mom?
It's a poisonous snake. No, Graham, no.
Yeah, I guess Ultima should probably be on the list ahead of some other stuff in here.
Like, why is World of Warcraft on when this list of much bigger things are not on the list?
No, it depends. They're just randomly applying their criteria. Because World of Warcraft is certainly very influential. It's played all around the world. People have played themselves to death playing it. It's had plenty of news. It's made tons of frickin' money. And it's one of the recognizable games.
Wow. So for MMO RPG, for that entire wannabe genre.
Completely won that genre.
Yeah, there is no genre, really, because there's World of Warcraft, and then there's a bunch of companies who keep trying to make a clone of World of Warcraft and fail horribly over and over and over again.
Second or third on that, though. Like, EverQuest was the big MMO before World of Warcraft decided they just destroy everything.
But that's the thing. Why isn't Evercrack on there? That would be more influential than World of Warcraft.
It has less longevity, and it didn't hit the mainstream quite as effectively as World of Warcraft, or even close.
But it paved the way
play
for
figures
World
on that are completely... Yeah, but the play figures are completely in different leagues.
Yeah, but the whole subscription, getting people to pay by subscription, it was really Evercrack that paved that way, which is the only reason World of Warcraft can exist.
I guess, but that's like picking a random platformer that existed before Mario and saying that that's the more influential thing over Mario. It doesn't really work. I mean, yeah, it gave them the idea that ultimately led to the platforming that you get in Mario, but people recognize Mario. Mario's the one that's made so much money. And
I'm kind of on the fence on that. I hear both sides, and it also makes me think of, and of course I'm going to bring this as a reference, when people start saying, hey, rank the best Star Trek franchises, and the argument, well, obviously you have to put the first Star Trek on there, because if there wasn't the first Star Trek, there wouldn't have been any subsequent Star Trek series. It's like, in and of itself, no, but it's the start of an argument, if you could then connect it to other points.
Yeah. The problem with that argument is that the character development and storylines in the first Star Trek stand up. So,
have you watched the other ones?
Yes.
I'm sorry, you're like, are you trying to put original series before like DS9 or something? What are we doing here?
I'm saying it deserves recognition for itself and not necessarily being better or worse than the others, but still is worthy of being mentioned.
Where's Call of Duty on this list?
Okay, no.
StarCraft.
Okay, I was gonna say, there's no RTS on this list. There's no
StarCraft win already or something? Are they excluding games that have won?
It hasn't even been nominated yet.
StarCraft from a list of games.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
Seriously, you want to talk about the only reason World of Warcraft exists? StarCraft.
Well, Warcraft 3 specifically led into World of Warcraft. And Warcraft 3 hated StarCraft. And Warcraft 2 is really good, too.
Yeah.
Especially its time. It was easily the best RTS for its time when it was made.
It's a fight with CNC on that one.
Oh, I guess, yeah. I didn't think that was out yet when I'm
saying
that. Well,
CNC and Red Alert, I don't think Red Alert was out at that time, but CNC was.
I have found something that may give us a little bit of context as to what this museum actually is. A list of exhibits that they have. Hot Wheels Race to Win. Pinball Playfields.
Oh,
Toy Halls of Fame. Butterfly Wings Dancing Garden, Play Pals, Regman's Kids Supermarket, Sesame Street, American Comic Book Heroes, The Bernstein Bears.
Okay, yeah.
You actually lost me at the dancing garden thing.
I have no idea what that is either.
So it's like...
We're basically debating what's included into like a ship of fools. It doesn't really matter, I guess.
It's all kid stuff. They don't understand gaming.
Yeah,
I mean, the strong museum of play, to me, it goes off the rails as soon as they start talking about their criteria, and then it's, oh, well, this pop culture thing, yeah, that's actually good enough. We can just ignore the rest if we want.
Yeah. So I was going to say, Street Fighter 2 is on the list, and fine, that part of the whole fighting genre, but I'm sorry, Mortal Kombat has far more pop culture references. It's longer had movies made out of it that were better than the Street Fighter movies.
Street Fighter,
but they were better than the Street Fighter movies. By far.
Well, the quality of those movies, you're splitting hairs a little, but yeah, I would agree. Mortal Kombat was less bad.
Yeah, it was less bad.
I want to talk about the Battleship movie. No.
How do they get away with putting Pac-Man on there above Pokemon? Because you ask kids today who Pac-Man is, and a lot of them are going to say, huh?
Dude. Don't even try and make that argument. You can walk away now.
There might be some fur flying here.
Pac-Man is by far more influential, more pop culture, more entertaining, more geographic reach, more longevity, more everything, especially influence over Pokemon.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I don't think Pac-Man's even close. Not that I like that that's the case, but I don't think Pac-Man's even close.
15 movies and like 700 episodes of anime.
I think The Simpsons is like one of the only longer running shows ever.
Yeah.
Quality of...
Well, quality aside...
I mean...
We're talking longevity as a criteria here, and Pokemon's among the tops on this list.
They have been the top-selling game on every Nintendo handheld since 1999.
Yeah, but all the real games are not even on Nintendo. I dare you to get Pokemon off the Nintendo and find out what happens to it.
Given that Pac-Man is already an inductee, and it was an inaugural inductee, I'm certainly okay with Pokemon being nominated.
Oh, I don't care about it being nominated. I just took exception to Candace thinking it was better than Pac-Man.
I know.
That was mostly to create controversy.
Yeah.
Well, success. The fur is flying.
Pac-Man has his own rights. He's good.
I will give the Strong Museum of Play some very, just minor credit. I really, really had to look for it. First, I'll give you credit for the intention, although you could even question that, especially with your criteria thing. But okay, you want to honor classic, influential, substantial video games over the course of the duration of the industry and the present day. Fine. When I look at the list of those titles that were nominated last year but not this year, there are only two that got nominated last year and didn't get in that are not nominated this year looking to get in. And that was FIFA and, oh, I'm going to have a hard time saying this, but I'm going to say it, Angry Birds.
FIFA?
Oh, thank God.
FIFA has
They threw in Madden instead of FIFA, basically. They swapped their EA titles.
Well, okay, in the U.S., people play Madden. In the rest of the world, they play FIFA.
Yeah, but... And,
yeah, FIFA outsells Madden.
How much
year.
Does FIFA outsell Madden?
Really?
Because, like, I don't know what the gaming market is in other countries. That's just not something I know.
Okay, let's find out.
It doesn't surprise me, seeing as how this museum is in the United States.
From 2014, the latest Madden sold 4.1 million copies in North America across all platforms, dwarfing FIFA's 14 North American sales of 2.12 million. Go figure, that's twice as much. These numbers are, of course, no surprise to American sports fans. Football is by far more popular.
Outside the U.S., it's
13.9
to 4.6.
Yeah,
okay. So FIFA does dwarf. I think FIFA should be included over Madden then.
Well, FIFA's made at EA Sports Canada, EAC, up in Vancouver, which also does the NBA, which also does all the other sports games, except for maybe the hockey, which goes back and forth between EAC and Montreal sometimes. So FIFA gets the benefit of all the other games also doing things, and so they can easily swap back and forth with, hey, this is a great way of doing this, so we'll do it this way, and it has that whole rollover. Whereas Madden has almost entirely been done in Tiburon, so it's completely separated out from the rest of the sports game. Question is, was it the first sports game? Like the original one?
I'm going to go with FIFA because I know Madden doesn't work and FIFA sold more. So there you go. I mean, Madden's still fun to play here and there, but it completely craps on strategy and football way too much.
So they're going to announce the winners in early May. Something else that actually came up Just in the article that's written here at Game Informer, it says being selected by a panel of journalists, academics, and others familiar with the video game industry, yet if you go to museumofplay.org, quote, final selections will be made on the advice of journalists, scholars, and other individuals familiar with the history of video games and their role in society, unquote. So when I see on the advice of, so whoever is behind the National Museum of Play is going to make the ultimate decision. Which also, tying into what Candace mentioned in terms of some of the exhibits there, combined with the fact that pop culture overrides all else in combination, let alone individually, it's like, yeah, the consistency is inconsistency.
I'd give Minecraft a nod for that whole builders open world block type game that spawned a bunch of other ones, and the fact that it got big.
And it's not as young as you think, because they were selling it when it was still an alpha stage. And thinking back now, that's like
2010.
Was it 2010? Okay. Yeah.
Same with I'm okay with World of Warcraft being on the list because of the MMORPG domination. Not necessarily okay with some of these other ones. Where is my burnout?
Mario Kart. Lol.
Well, if we can still mention things that are missing, the Diablo franchise, I'd say just because it started the genre, and Diablo 3 is like, what, the best-selling PC game behind Minecraft?
Diablo 3? You mean that game that people use as a marketplace to sell stuff and don't actually play the game?
Some people still play it.
The auction house was patched out like 2 years ago or something.
Yeah, that was a major misplay by Blizzard, but to their credit, they at least rescinded it.
If you're going to go Diablo, it's Diablo 2. Diablo 2 by far.
That definitely shifted the genre, yeah. The whole thing is inconsistent, though. But, like, for most of these games here, if you're just talking about only the installment depicted, it doesn't have nearly as much weight. Like, Final Fantasy was not that good of a game, but its progression since then.
Because Red and Green are the ones that everybody loved to death.
So it's dead.
I personally like the later ones better, but, you know.
Oh, it's like Zelda, too. The original Zelda doesn't hold up as well as some of the things that came after it in the series.
Where's the golfing game? Why isn't that on the list?
Ugh.
Because only Dan plays golf?
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Wait a minute now.
According to Uber in the chat, 1988 for Madden.
Yeah, that's old.
Although, if we're talking the most influential member of a franchise, I wouldn't say the original Civ. I'd say maybe Civ 2 for really getting off the rails, or just Civ 5 for how massively popular it is.
No.
I mean, you could go 2, 4, or 5, but I would say 2 would be the huge. Yeah, definitely 3.
Definitely 3.
3 is influential because 3 showed us just
what
just,
not to do.
Yeah, just how bad it could be.
And then 4 came along and said, oh my god.
I would put Civ 2 ahead of Civ 1 for this list as well. Although if we want to talk about how badly Civ can go, I mean, yeah, there's Civ 3, but then I guess if we're talking direct lineage. Okay, yeah. we'll just stick to direct lineage.
Let's skip.
We don't have to name the other ones.
Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
This has been Polycast episode 252. I've been joined by people who have names, I'm sure. Might be called Kenneth Albinus.
I should think of something to put here, but I forgot.
Matt said,
did sort of Canadian.
Okay, at least I... It was not Z, because that would have been sad.
That would have been very offensive to my heritage.
Okay, I would have just called it Zed anyways. Doesn't matter to me, even if it was offensive the other way. And of course, Mr. Quick.
Civilization, the gaming franchise that's been turning everything but tricks since 1991.
No, I'm just...
What?
Yeah, I... No. No. I'm pretty sure a few have been done. And of course, the Mean Team.
No man team, no spleen.
All right. See ya.
Peace.
That escalated quickly.
Record date April 2nd, 2016. Civilization 2 and Civilization 2 Test of Time theme, copyright Microprose. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.